Welcome. We're going to get started. My name is Aviva, and I'm very happy to be here with all of you. I've actually never been in this room before, and it's a very inspiring room to do a little bit of learning about prayer. So if at any point you're wanting to get a little bit of, stimulation besides what's happening in the class, you can glance at anything on the wall and see what it makes you think about prayer. So you all have source sheets now, and you should put them down and not look at them for a minute. I wanted to start off by generating some words that we associate with prayer. And what I would like you to do is think of a place that you often go to pray, like a particular synagogue. And we'll just generate sort of reflex. Don't think about it too hard. What are some of the attitudes or adjectives that you associate with prayer in those places that you go to pray?
Connection.
Contemplative.
Struggle.
Meditation.
Long periods of boredom.
That was a few words, long periods of boredom. Okay, boredom. We'll put some hyphens boredom. In between.
Acknowledgement.
Distracted.
Gratitude.
Humbled. There are times I feel I'm judging the quality of a performance.
Spectator performance in the attitude of judging others' performance.
Atonement.
Hospitality.
So the big kiddush.
Vulnerability.
Pleading.
Of our audio collage. And as we're working through some different material related to prayer, hopefully we'll get to bounce back to some of these words and see ways in which those words might be getting louder, or maybe some of those words will have some challenges, and maybe we'll add new words to what we think of when we think of prayer. By way of introduction, one of the most kind of common things about Jewish prayer is its routine, right? And the fact that it's done three times a day, at least according to Rabbi's description of how it should be done. And the source for praying three times a day, anybody know where it might come from biblically? The Avot. Did any of the Avot, our patriarchs, pray three times a day? No, that's fine.
Daniel?
I'm talking about Midrash. Yeah, okay. So the rabbis associate each of the prayers with the Avot, but in terms of a person who prayed three times a day, as far as we know, the first is, I heard it over here.
Daniel.
In the whole entire Tanakh, the one story that we have of an actual person praying three times a day is Daniel. Now, it does say he prays like he did in days of yore, so it seems like this may have been a tradition, but who's an actual person who prays three times a day, the first is Daniel in a very, very late period in the Bible. Now, what was his reward for praying three times a day? He gets thrown into the lion's den. So his act of prayer is actually construed as extremely political, at least the way that the story is told. More complicated full story, but In some ways, right, the first person we know of who prayed three times a day, that is actually seen as a strong political act of protest, right, by turning to an authority other than the flesh and blood ruler of the time, and lands him in the lion's den. And I just want to bring that to frame. What we are going to explore is the overlap between prayer and protest. And that might lead various individuals in the room in various directions in terms of what that means in your own life, and hopefully we'll have room for some of that, and some of that might be something you can make on your own. But that's what I really want to put out there, is exploring in our word collage the word protest as part of what is happening in prayer. Okay. So you're allowed to look at your source sheet now. Some of you may have already read the whole thing. Yes. Anybody else missing? Yes. Okay. So for this theme of protest, I'm not sort of coming up with this word on my own. There is another biblical scene that we'll use to frame our learning, which is the scene of Abraham arguing with God about the destruction of Sodom. Which I think pretty clearly, if I were to ask you, what is Abraham doing in that moment? You would probably say something like protest, right? But would you say that he's doing prayer?
Well, he's talking to God.
He's talking to God.
He's not praying.
Arguing with God. I don't know that if I'm reading through the story of the Tanakh and I'm looking for a moment of Avraham in prayer, I point to that one. Interestingly, in the source that you referenced, where the rabbis associate the patriarchs with prayer, the moment that they turn to Avraham is after the destruction of Sodom, when he's back at that place where he'd spoken to God. That's a bit of an aside. But there's a midrash that does very explicitly read this as prayer, and it's not just a historical association between prayer and protest, okay? So I brought you the verse from Bereshit, where Avraham steps up, and after God says that God will destroy the city of Sodom, right? And the verb that is used in the text here in Bereshit is Vayigash, Avraham. Avraham approached, or Avraham drew near to God. And that is the beginning of his argument with God. Now, on that verse and on that verb, that Avraham approached God, the Midrash says, this is source number 2, Rabbi Pinchas, Rabbi Levi, Rabbi Yochanan, in the name of Menachem de Galia, so we have a number of sages associated with this statement, one who goes before the ark to lead prayers, we do not say to him, come and do. Bova'aseh, come and do our prayers. That's not what we say. Rather, what we say is, bova'karev, come and draw near, literally, though the word krav can also mean battle. And you see this in the next phrase that I bolded. Bova aseh melchamtenu, come wage our war. That is the invitation for the person leading prayers. Come wage our war. Bova aseh korban shel tzibur, come and offer the offering for the community. Right, where that's clearly, there's a correlation there between prayer and sacrifices, but I think what is happening here in seeing prayer as a sacrifice in this context of war is appeasement, potentially. Right? Come, do this thing. We're in war. We're in war with God. Come and appease God, right, to fight on our behalf. I want to hear some of your responses to this, right? This move of the Midrash to read Avraham's argument with God as prayer. And to see that prayer as actually a paradigm for prayer in future generations for us as well, that what we are doing in prayer is fighting about. Okay, flesh this out a little bit. What does this mean for prayer to be a battle? What is this battle about? What are we doing when we're praying in that battle? Yes, Richard.
One of the easier models to perhaps get to the Abraham model is Yehuda with Yosef, because there you clearly see that Yehuda is trying to stop Yosef from doing something militarily or terrible.
Okay, great. So just to fill in.
How to make the case to appease him or to get it done.
Okay, great. So to fill in some of the background there, the word Vayigash, and he drew near, is also the title of one of the Parshiot in Bereshit, as we read it, right? Vayigash, Elav Yehuda, when Judah approaches Joseph, trying to ensure that Benjamin won't be enslaved forever.
Right. So there's a clear, and it just seems like it fits the war metaphor better that Joseph's got imprisoned Benjamin. We don't know that it's Joseph. You know, Judah doesn't know it's Joseph. He assumes this is some Egyptian who's now jailed and forcibly detained. I don't even know a lot about right now. Benjamin, and how do you get him out?
Okay, so that's sort of an intertext here where the model there is Yehuda approaches Yosef, but really that's sort of the supreme ruler of Egypt, right? Trying to intercede, gets what he wants, and that is our word for Yigash, and he approached. And similarly, right, Abraham on the brink of the destruction of Sodom is approaching God to try to intercede and wage the war. Yeah.
One of the things I'm confused about is God's participation in the war. Because when I read Milchamtehu, I think about like the experience on the human plane of being at war with God, but I'm not so sure that God's a participant in that way. And when we think of, in human terms, like two armies with their competing, I don't know, for some reason, there's just seem of isolation. There's a loneliness to the war. It seems to be very much lived on a human plane.
Okay. Great, so this is sort of, maybe we're interfacing with our audio collage word struggle that we probably think of as our own personal struggle with God. What's happening here in the war model, it's like this isn't totally fleshed out here. Right? I would say it seems clear that Abraham is on the attack against God, and we'll follow that theme a little bit later on. And it seems like God in this story is on the attack against Sodom. Right, so that seems to be God's participation here. Right? God is actually about to destroy the people who God has deemed worthy of death. And Abraham is interceding.
But that's not what God actually tells him. That's what he assumes. God simply says he's going to go to Pakar. Investigate.
In this story.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So it might not be that, like, Abraham sees God pointing at God.
He thinks God is.
But yeah, and I do think if you take this seriously, then like, if this is what we're saying to the person who's about to lead services, come wage our war, just like Abraham is waging war for Sodom, then who are we in this story, right? Who is the Kahal in this story? It seems like it's Sodom. That we're actually identifying with the Sodomites here, who have sinned, deserve to die, and actually every single day, when like, if God were to judge us properly, then maybe we are not that different than the people in Sodom, but we have our person stepping up, waging war on our behalf to ensure
that justice in Sodom.
Go badly.
Or it might be the righteous in Sodom that Abraham is representing. He's not necessarily representing all the wicked. Asking God, are you
going to
sweep away the righteous?
Right.
And is it on our behalf? Or are we each person, each Jew internally struggling with God? Or are we asking somebody to come down for us?
Right. So this model in the Midrash imagines that the person leading services is going on our behalf, just like
aren't we all doing it?
But yeah, to the extent that we're all praying, right, it might be that we think of our own prayers every single day as taking that step that Abraham took. Okay. I hear your point, right? And I guess my point of throwing in Sodom and who are we in the story is mostly to kind of throw that out as a question that this midrash opens up. But what I want to follow through on now is really with your point, maybe we're all Abraham in this story when we pray. Is this image and metaphor of prayer as jumping in on the attack against God?
I mean, one thing I think you can clearly say is it's asymmetrical warfare in the sense that there's God and there's humble little man. And it does, even in Abraham's argument, Tzadikim Rasha, you know, he's kind of, it's praise of God, but turning that praise around, which is what you need to do if you have no power on your own. So it changes the argument a little bit. You argue from through praise, but in the praise is hidden maybe a little
critique.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. We'll run with this, I think, as we go on. Okay, what I want to do next is look at the model of Hannah. We're really going to spend most of our time with Hannah, who is the model for Jewish prayer in a lot of different ways, but I think sometimes underestimated in the power of the model of what she is doing when she prays. So we're going to look at the part of the story where the text in the book of Shmuel says that she prays to God, right, and just filling in some other context that we have. Hannah, who is childless, her co-wife Penina has many children. This is a source of deep aggravation and bitterness for Hannah all the time. And then we have the story zone in on a particular moment when the family goes to Shiloh, which is the site of the Mikdash, or the Mishkan at that time, and the sort of site of all of religious leadership at that time, right? And the place that everybody goes to bring their sacrifices, the place that everybody goes to worship God. So in terms of how do we think about what prayer is, connection, right? This is her going to that place where people go to seek out God. And what I want to do is have you read this short passage here of the book text with the chavruta. Anybody sitting next to you, though ideally somebody you haven't studied with yet, so you might have to get up and move to make that happen. And as you are reading through this, I want you to generate some sort of list of what seems to be Hannah's attitudes or what adjectives describe her, and also verbs. What is she doing in this text? Okay? So take not much more than 5 minutes with a chavruta next to you to read through just source number 3 here and tell me when you come back what are Hannah's attitudes in this passage. And we're going to come back together because this is actually mostly a class that is focused on rabbinic interpretations of Hannah, and it's not a biblical class, though it could be an entire hour and a half or hours and hours on just the story itself. Okay, what do we have? What does Hannah seem to be doing, and what is her general attitude in this passage?
She says a lot of words, but they can't be heard.
Says words and they can't be heard. Okay. Yeah.
This struck me as what Kubler Ross talks about as bargaining. She basically says, listen, God, here's the deal. I will provide you, if you provide me a son, I will provide them, he will serve you. And she finds the prayer affects her emotional state, because at the end she's no longer sad. After her dialogue with Eli, she came to it very sad, and it says she, Marat, it's a bitterness. And at the end it says she's no longer sad. So the prayer for that moment transformed her mood.
Okay, so something certainly transforms her mood. She's very bitter. She leaves, and Ufanah lo hayu la'ot, she doesn't have the same countenance. It's either the prayer, the vow, which may or may not be the same thing as the prayer, or her conversation with Abe, right, the high priest. Those three things happen, and then her whole kind of attitude around this changes. In terms of the negotiating thing, yes, this is a one vow of, I believe, five vows in the Tanakh, in the Bible, right? Five vows that have this bargaining kind of quality around them. It's a motif in other ancient Near Eastern sources as well. The model of the vow here is like a Ugaritic text that has a similar model of the vow, so that bargaining piece through the vow seems to be very much part of what is happening and how people negotiate with God at the time. And is that the same as her prayer? Is it different than her prayer? Because we know what she prays, she vows, her mood entirely changes. Yeah.
So you're raising it as a question. I guess we sort of came up, I think, with the assumption that the vow is separate, and so we never really get the text of her prayer. It seems even more like she prays a little bit first, then she makes this vow, then she prays a little bit more, because it's about to pull out Al Hashem, right, which the text will pick up on later.
Mm-hmm.
But then she makes a prayer, and then she's about to pull out again.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't really know what exactly she said.
Yeah, and the batik palel again is following this. Yeah. Is that what you're referring to? Following this passage. And
so
there we actually have the text of her prayer of gratitude. Right. So after this, I didn't give this to you, but after she gets a son, she has a prayer of gratitude. It's a beautiful poem.
But that's later. That's not this.
But what you're pointing out is later on when we see she prays, we see the words of what she prays. At
it's
this
also
point
cool,
in verse 10,
really
it says
never...
that she prays, but either we assume that the vow is her prayer, or she prayed, as Marcia said, she's moving her lips, but nobody can hear what she's saying. Maybe we have no idea of what her prayer was, or she didn't even have words. Yeah,
and then the other piece was, you know, never really focused on it this way, but once you say, well, think about prayer as war, you realize, wow, there's a lot of war terminology going on here. Hashem Tzibaot. And then she's got, what else did she have? It was more like, she had Ba'eshpoch, like Shepoch al Chamatka. So we have that she poured out,
15.
Like the way God did. We have Eli saying Lech L'Shalom, like the war's over now, you can go home safe. So it was interesting to see sort of this war imagery, which wouldn't necessarily have noticed before.
Okay, we'll develop that a little bit more. Okay, any other thoughts? Is there anything we've missed in her attitude, posture, the attributes you described? Yes.
It says that she prayed and cried, and I think maybe the crying is part of the prayer.
Yeah. Right? In the very beginning, verse 10, right? Maybe she prayed is actually further defined by she cried. Like that
she,
might be
she
the
cried and vowed. Maybe that's the content of the prayer.
Yeah. Okay, yes.
It, she does it a lot.
She doesn't
watch.
There's the emphatic
well,
crying in verse
12. And in verse 12, which she is, she's praying a lot.
Yes.
And then again, when she explains it, she says, out of the abundance of my charity.
Mm-hmm. Right,
so
in verse 16,
may robe
see
three different times we hear how much of it there is.
Okay, great. Excessive. Good source for praying three times a day. If there's one word about Jewish prayer, maybe excessive should be the word. Yes.
She describes herself as an angry woman.
Yeah.
And unlike her husband, Eli doesn't tell her, you shouldn't be angry, you should be actually thankful for your lot. But he recognizes and says, well, I hope that God will give you your request, even though she never told him that she made
the
request.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so she might get some sort of validation or acknowledgement here that she has never gotten before.
And with respect to the previous discussion about Abraham, it says, come and do the public sacrifice.
Yeah.
So she got kind of support from the high priest, the person whose job is to make the public sacrifice.
Yes. Okay, we're going to have to think about that a little bit more. In fact, that this is the site where sacrifices happen, that is how people worship, and here she and her prayer is having this personal interaction with the person who's really the leader of that whole system. What is her attitude like towards Amy?
Aggressive.
Aggressive? What makes you say aggressive?
No.
She contradicts him.
Yeah. Okay, what's her second word?
Yeah, she cares for the microphone.
Her second word, Aduni, my master. Aggressive, but also polite.
Subservient.
She's
Ramatecha multiple times.
Okay.
As well, it's kind of that combo. She's...
She
angry at him or angry at God or angry in general, but also I'm your maidservant, so like both things are there.
She's standing up for herself. I think that's part of what the sadness goes by, because whether she's going to get her wish granted or not, at least she acknowledged herself and stood up for herself, mm-hmm. both to God and to
Okay, so this little... Deeping in more to this question of what causes this transformation, her attitude, is it partly her speech towards Amy the High Priest? And okay, this is so great. The next source here is basically right above Sneaky's head. We have our learner service delineation, and this is so perfect. Number four, Amida, silent devotion. I would say if there's anything motivating this class, it is that kind of chart that you could find anywhere, right? And this brings us to source number four. It's even number four. Okay, this is beautiful to share. Right, I think most often, what is the thing that we generally think of that we learn from Chana about prayer? It's based on Rav Hamnuna, a sage among the Babylonian sages of the Talmud. And he says, how many great laws can be derived from the verses of Chana that we all just read? She's speaking on her heart. From here we learn that one who prays must direct his heart. I would say that's the devotion aspect of this prayer, of this chart here. Silent devotion, right? It's from the heart. Only her lips were moving. From here we learn that you have to literally cut the words with your lips or form the words with your lips. You can't just have something silent happening in the head. Have to form the words with your lips. And probably the most famous, Kola Loishama, couldn't hear her voice. And from here, this is very strong formulation. We learn that it is forbidden to raise one's voice. It's not just like she happened to be quiet, great, a nice description. No, this is turned into normative law. It is prohibited to raise your voice in prayer, right? So this would be Rav Hamnuna behind the parentheses, silent devotion, on that chart, on the wall. And our Amida meant to mimic her devotion and her silence. Okay, but that's not the only way to read what is happening here. And what I really want to spend time with is a whole different tradition of how to interpret Chana and these verses in the Torah that are coming from a sage in Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Elazar. Okay, so he's in the land of Israel in the times of the Talmud. And I want to frame it with this piece in source number five. This is a continuation of, the Talmud goes on for more than a daf, about a daf and a half, about Chana and her prayer and what we learn about prayer from her. So he says, Amar Rabbi Elazar, Chana heticha divrim klapei mala. Chana literally shot words at God. Right? And heticha, I believe, is from the same root as kimetacha vekeshet, like shooting a bow and arrow. Okay, so I think the concrete image of what she is doing when she prays, this goes back to Toby speaking up, she is shooting her words. It's like her lips are the bow, and her words are the arrows flying from her mouth, pointed at God. How do we know this? How does he say such a thing? Well, he has a nice little letter in the Torah to rest this interpretation on. Shenamar, as it says in the verse, Vatit Paleo al Hashem. She prayed on God. We don't usually pray on God. We usually pray to God, El, with an Aleph. Okay? So the fact that this verse has an ayin instead of an aleph opens up, linguistically, obviously there's more, but opens up this possibility of interpreting Chana's posture here as literally attacking God by shooting words at God. And then she's not alone. She's part of a triad in this section of the Talmud, Chana, Moshe, and Eliyahu, who are the three people in the Bible who shoot words at God. And we can look more there to see what they did, but people who are speaking at, Jastrow gives here for more, a less concrete interpretation of it, to speak intimately. Okay, to have chutzpah. Okay, so this is what I want to follow. Now, Rabbi Elazar goes on to give a sort of extremely lengthy exposition of many phrases in this passage in the Tanakh. And we're going to follow along with his interpretation here and try to flesh out this picture of Chana attacking God in her words. And I would say the point of this is not just to describe what she did, but if we're going to hold her up as a model of prayer, then it's not just the silent devotion piece of what she does that we need to learn from. Right? I want to sort of put forth that Rabbi Elazar's interpretation of what she's doing and shooting words at God may be something that we need to take with us to understand what that whole prayer thing is about that we're meant to do three times a day. Okay, so we're on page 3 now, source number 6. Vayomer Eliha Eli said to her, "How long will you be drunk?" Rabbi Elazar said, "From here we learn that one who observes something inappropriate in his friend must rebuke him." Okay, so he's taking each verse and reading it not only as a description, but as something to learn from. He thinks she's drunk. He's the high priest, meant to keep the culture of respect, reverence in this place. It is proper for him to rebuke Chana. This next paragraph, I think, is really the most critical in terms of what is going on here. Chana responded and said, "Lo Adoni, no, my master." Right? These are the words that Richard drew us to before. Amar Ula v'itima Rabbi Yosei b'Rabbi Chanina. Amra la, she said to him, get ready, "Lo Adon ata b'davar zeh. You are not a master in this matter." Okay, so instead of putting the comma after lo, no, comma, my master, where my master was mitigating her aggressive no, actually, we're emphasizing her aggressive no. "Lo Adonata, you are not a master regarding this thing," regarding, we'll have to think about what this thing means. And God's spirit does not rest on you, such that you would be suspicious of me regarding this. What do you mean that this is? You are not a master in this matter.
Who's her?
What?
This being drunk.
Being drunk could be. Could be you're not a master regarding what it looks like to be drunk.
Her sorrow.
Her sorrow, meaning like, I know the innerness of my heart. Sort of leg yodan marat nafsho. We have that word elsewhere in the Talmud. A person knows of their own bitterness. But you are not a master over my inner spirit. Could be.
Prayer.
Well, that's an interesting thing to say to the high priest, who's the leader of his worship.
But she's seeing what his sons have been doing.
Yeah, okay, so the broader context here is he has sons who are totally corrupt, right? Just eating whatever they can, sacrifices, doing.
He's sleeping with them to come.
Sleeping with them to bring the sacrifices. Yes, okay, so this could certainly be sort of a takedown of his leadership on, you know, being at the center of a place people come to approach God when he's really presiding over a corrupt system or practice. But yeah, I think also it's like, really? Ailey's never seen anybody pray, right? He can't possibly know anything about prayer if he sees what she's doing and doesn't understand that is prayer.
He does sacrifice. I mean, he works in the sacrificial system.
Yes.
But it's a wordless system, right?
Yeah.
So he doesn't know what words. It's like, this is not your area of expertise, honey.
Yeah, I know. Yes. So I think you're right. And this is why the rabbis sort of see this as a moment of a shift from the system of sacrifices to the system of prayer. But it is a little bit hard to imagine that, like, you know, there's no formal words that go along with sacrifices, but it's hard to imagine that, like, nobody has ever said anything in sort of an emotional, like, request towards God in that setting. But yeah, this is sort of the moment of revolution, the way that the rabbis wants to tell the story. Okay, it gets even worse here. Ikad Amrei, some say, Hachi Amrei, this is what she said, Lo Adonata, period. Not just, you're not a master, right? You're not an expert regarding prayer, or you're not an expert regarding me and my experience, but you are not a master at all. Lo Adonata, right? God's presence is just not on you, period. It's not just, oh, you messed up here. It's, if this could happen and you didn't recognize that I was praying in this moment, then you actually are not at all a representative of God on this earth. You judged me. Unfavorably rather than favorably. Didn't you know that I am a distressed woman? Right now, sort of totally blind. And, okay, so in terms of the posture of this, right, we have shifted from anything that was mitigating in the pasuk about Hannah's sort of aggression towards Eli, right, that word agamim, the last word, is being subverted, right, and now this is entirely a description of Hannah speaking up aggressively towards Eli, and really, I would say, knowing from her own sense of prayer and what prayer means, that this apparent power, right, this apparent figure of power and expertise regarding prayer is actually wrong. Right, so it's really her speaking up to power, speaking up to human power, and in this moment, and taking them down. Okay, thoughts on this? Do you find this a compelling reading of this section of the story in the Tanakh? Do you think this is a stretch thus far? Is this the same Hannah I'm reading before? Yeah.
Again, given the context that Eli is not, Eli is the villain in the story in many ways, the priest who doesn't really know what's going on, then I can say you can read that Han is the one who has some insight, and the person he's accusing me of drug is the one who really has insight here, so I think it can be read that way. I think it's reasonable to me.
Mm-hmm. So kind of emphasizing a certain stream that does exist in the book. Yeah, maybe magnifying it a little more than it is there, where she's still somewhat submissive.
Well, yeah, I think she gives up her child, and then she's kind of then she has her prayer of thanksgiving, and she's done. She doesn't have an active role in it. I mean, she doesn't have too active role well after this, but.
There was one way that I wanted to just tone down what Hannah's saying, because she turns over the child to Eli.
In the biblical text, you want to tone down what she's saying.
So I'm not sure that she's fully against Eli.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so in that way, this does seem to be sort of a swerve to read her as being so, right, so against him and so kind of undermining his authority.
Both Talmudic texts agree that it's a disruptive moment.
Yeah.
Because the first one doesn't say she reveals all these laws. Because clearly Eli didn't know the laws, and so whether you like her or don't like her, she was what she was doing was innovative and historic.
Do you think that one of these texts likes her and one doesn't?
Yeah. I mean, I think the one that we just finished reading
doesn't like her.
Did not like her, but he thinks that she's irreverent and is not speaking. Nicely to
and that's good. A reason not to like her? Those are good? That's
I think that's good, but I'm not sure either.
Just keep in mind, the other people in his category of those who shoot words at God are Moshe and Eliyahu in this triad. So I don't know that disturbing words at God is a reason not to like the character. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
I think the shooting words at Eli, which is what we're
talking about,
is, I guess, and I'm not looking at it from the Talmudic view, but I'm looking at it from the psychological view, is just her, she has such rage and such sorrow that she, you know, she just transfers it onto him.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure if it's as valid for us to believe.
As it's as valid to...
To say it's all, that she's so shifting towards him. I think some of it is fallout. He's just standing in her way. She's contemplative. She's trying to look at what's going on.
Yeah.
She's trying to be in it. And I think this... But I think it's a little bit of a transference of her anger.
On him.
But that's not a biblical.
Right. I mean, I guess the question is, does the Talmudic reading of it, where Lo Adoni becomes you are not a master, make that more intentional? And less, just kind of like overflow of.
Yeah, I think that is what I think.
Yeah.
I think this is typical of stories in general, in particular, and certainly in the Tanakh, that you have the unexpected person taking a leading role.
Mm-hmm.
Like the younger son is the one. It's no story if the older son is the one who gets the inheritance. There's nothing to say. That's what always happens. So when the younger son has it, now we got a story.
Right.
And here the woman taking the reins and taking the initiative to make something happen, which you would normally be expected to just follow along, that's a story.
Great. Okay, this is a story. It's a sort of a more compelling story. And the question is, what are we supposed to be doing with that story? So I want to go to the next section I want to look at, which I think really builds off of what you are saying in terms of the marginal figure becoming the center of the story.
Just say one.
Okay.
Before we get that part.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this is a beautiful model of a woman's ability, this woman's ability, and some other women's ability, to do both things at the same time, for it to be both speaking up and getting the message across and standing up for herself, and at the same time doing it in a respectful way that is mitigating the rocked arrow that's being shot at the high priest.
Yes.
And still getting the message across, but getting it across in a very mild, pleasant, respectful way.
Right. I would agree with you. What?
And Rabbi Aviva does this particularly well, so I think that ought to be brought out.
I think that's a good reading of the Tanakh, right, of the story Bible. But I think that when the rabbis run with this, they are really making it more of a dig, right? To say, you are not a master, period, instead of, no, I'm a master. I think it's really emphasizing that side. But yes, I agree that she's sort of doing a balancing act.
Could it be?
Yes.
Lo Adoni, like, you're not my master.
So yeah, that would be great, but it's actually interesting that that's not the way Rabbi Mununa reads it, right? It's Lo Adonata, you are not a master.
She says Lo Adonata.
She says Lo Adonata, but she doesn't say Lo Adon Sheli, right? You're not my master. It's a very interesting thing, right? That's why I'm saying, I think it makes it a much broader takedown than it. Even if you did that punctuation switch, instead of Lo Adoni, no, my master, you turned it into Lo Adoni, you're not my master, that would be more tentative than Lo Adonata, you're not a master, and God's presence isn't with you. I mean, it's kind of insane how far she goes in this, according to the Midrash. Right? And that's what I mean, I think this is, in terms of the plot of the story, I think it's a good reading of sort of calling out a corrupt religious leader. Okay, so now we're going to go on, and actually we're going to talk about this, it's more about prayer, again, so I think that they're deeply intertwined, and look at Roman numeral 2, which then tackles her attitude towards God, right, and I think will help us run with this marginal figure piece. So, my suggestion is find a new person to sit with for the next 10 minutes, and you're going to read through Roman numeral 2 here, It's going to give you a metaphor or an analogy. And what you want to do when you read this analogy is what you do anytime you read any analogy in any of the book sources or anything. Just try to map out the characters and the scenes in the analogy to the story of Akana. Okay? So who how does each character in the analogy map onto the characters in the biblical text here? How do the scenes map out? And how does this affect your reading of what Hannah is doing in this moment and what her prayer is about? Okay? How about 10 minutes? Should we act out the story? Do we have
more person?
Great, go for it. Okay, what is everybody else?
We're all at the feast. We're eating.
In the analogy.
We're the nasty people of the party.
You're the nasty party. Start from the beginning. Yes.
She vowed a vow and said, God of multitudes. Rav Eleazar said, from the day that the Holy Blessed One created the world, and there was no person who referred to the Holy Blessed One as multitudes until Hannah came and called him multitudes.
Okay, sorry about the hymn there. Yeah, I think this is actually right. If you're marching through the Torah, you would never have somebody who directly addresses God as Tzivakot, right? Multitudes until Hannah.
Can we pause for a moment though and talk about what it is? That literally the word? Because I always thought of it as army.
Yeah, so it can mean army, host. We're not going to hyperlink to everything about that.
It's just the stars.
And what it means. But yes, it seems like it often refers to sort of celestial beings, stars.
God, it's a military term.
It's associated
with the army. Yes, and associated also with the military, that a military is a large gathering of people. Okay, great. New name for God. What are we going to do?
Hannah said before the Holy Blessed One, Master of the universe, of all the multitudes of multitudes that you created in your world, is it so difficult in your eyes to give me one child?
Okay, great. So she's looking at all the people in the world, so difficult to give me one child. There's one version of this Midrash that associates this with everyone's going up to Shiloh because it's one of the three pilgrimage festivals. So that she is actually seeing sort of the entirety of the nation gathering at this time, and actually sort of we're looking at all these people, and I think there's sort of a whole reading of Hannah that relates to experience of infertility. It's an extremely profound and poignant text, right? But one thing is these times of celebration, and so many people are gathered together, right? All she sees is all of these people, and she does not have one child. Okay.
A parable. To what is this similar? To a king of flesh and blood who made a feast for his servants.
This is your feast.
One poor person came and stood at the doorway.
Great, go on.
He said to them, give me one slice of bread.
That's her line.
One slice of bread. One slice of bread.
Okay, but hold on.
They don't pay any attention.
Okay, keep going, narrator.
They didn't pay attention to him.
That feels bad.
He pushed through
Wonder Woman
and came to the king. He said to him,
just one slice of bread. My master, the king.
Of the whole feast that you made, is it so hard in your eyes
to give me one slice of bread?
And the king is silent. Beautiful. Well done.
Well played. Your lines were great.
Okay.
Is that the end of the Avada?
That's the end of the Avada, yes. That's the end of this scene. End scene.
Interesting.
That is interesting. Yeah, we'll talk about that in 1 second. Before we get to the end and how it ends, you map our players onto the story. I know this might seem obvious, but who is who? Who is whom? Yes.
God.
Yeah, God. The core person is Hannah, and the people that ignore her are Eli.
People who ignore her are Eli.
Hanina.
Penina, other people who have known her?
Are the children?
Her husband. Okay, so the most fruitful part of the story, in a way, is all those people who in the story seems like could have given her, or the poor person, that slice of bread, and don't. And how does that map out to her experience, right, and the obstacles that she has faced in getting this request? Okay, so we have some who want to put Ailey there. Does he ignore her? Misreads her.
There's a problem.
What's the problem?
None of the people who refuse to give the poor man the bread are analogous to Ailey, or to who refuse. You know, Ailey doesn't refuse to give Hannah a child.
Right.
Ailey is stuck just like she is. And it's not a very good mashal for this situation. That's why I asked you, is it the end?
Yeah, and it is the end.
What I said to Marcia is it reminded me of the situation in Bereishit where Rachel complains to Jacob. And Jacob said, Rachel is unhappy in precisely the same way. Her sister has got all these boys, and she's got nothing. And Rachel says to Jacob, give me sons or I will die. And Jacob says to her, am I God that I could do this? So everybody's in agreement that this is God's doing. I mean, we know the mechanics, as I said, we know the mechanics of pregnancy, but it's miraculous. That's what they're saying. And we get that. Everybody feels that. But we can't help her. Whereas the people at the party could do something for the poor man.
I just want to pause for one second and say, the reason that we do this mapping out of the characters and the analogy to the biblical text that it's supposed to represent is precisely to arrive at how it's a bad analogy, right? And the more that you have that opportunity whenever you have a mashal to find the places of misfit, that's actually what you want to sort of latch onto, because it helps to unpack, right, what are some assumptions that we're making about the biblical story, and sort of we can read that story perhaps more deeply, or perhaps in a non-intuitive way. It might be asking us to get something different from the story than what the story is saying. But we had a number of comments here. Yeah?
I think there is much, the fable is sensitive in that it doesn't say they didn't give him a piece of bread. Mm-hmm. They didn't notice him, basically.
Right.
And the problem for Hannah, that's, I think, why she's happy, why she loses her sadness after talking with Ailey, is that no one recognizes that there is a problem, that she has a problem. Pina just scorns her. Her husband tells her that I'm better for 10 sons. Why are you complaining? There is no reason to complain. Ailey is the first person who accepts the idea that she has a problem.
Yes.
And so all these people who are participating in the feast in the sense that they have children, refuse to admit that there is a problem here. Unlike maybe in the case of Yaakov and Rachel, where Yaakov admits, I know that you have a problem, but I can't help you.
Yeah. And just to push this a little bit, it's not that Ailey then asks, what is the problem? At no point does she ever communicate to Ailey what her actual problem is. So when I was asking, well, you know, where is Ailey in this story? Who are the people who don't pay attention to her? Ailey does pay attention to her, but he basically first says, leave, and then says, go in peace when you get your request, but at no point does he actually ask her, what do you need?
But Ailey is
pain. He doesn't acknowledge her pain.
He does if he doesn't.
No, and they don't acknowledge the poor man's pain. That's
right. Yeah, so I don't know. I don't know what is behind Ailey's go in peace when you get your request. Like, does that feel like she's going to pay attention to you? Or does it not? Right. So I think that's sort of a question that this mashal forces us to ask. at what point does Hana, what are all the moments where she feels that she's trying to interface with people who are ignoring her, right? And what is her moment of breakthrough? Yes?
So what happens if actually God in the Hana story is the servants? Because in the story, she is not answered by God.
In the analogy, you're saying?
No, when she prays, she has an interaction with Eli. She doesn't have an interaction with God that's two-dimensional. She comes, the first contact she makes is with God, and she's ignored. Just bear with me here.
Okay.
I don't know where it's going. And then she goes through God and interacts with Eli. I don't know where that goes, but I do have something else that's bothering me, and that is that it says that God is called Tzevaot, which is the multitudes, and the Avadim are the multitudes in the metaphor story as well. The singular is Eli.
Yeah, so I think that based on all of sort of our motifs of rabbinic analogies, that where there is a king, the
must
king sort of has to be God. And I think the way that this works in terms of the name calling God Tzevaot multitudes is it's God of. There's really a lot going in that of in this rabbinic interpretation, right? It's God of multitudes. Who are the multitudes? All the people in the world. I think actually, if anything, the being ignored by the servants and pushing through to the king is more analogous to her desire to go straight to God in her prayer. When she's at the site of worship where everything generally goes through the priest and the sacrifice. Right? So
yeah,
I think that it might
Ellie,
be that...
Not Ellie ignoring her.
It could be, but I think it could be more that sort of the whole system of Korbanot that she's engaged in for years and years and years, it's not working, right? And so she pushes through directly to the king, and she pushes through directly to God, as opposed to dealing with the sort of intermediaries between her and God. But so I think, so the sort of image that I want to leave you with, and you might have been mistaken, but initial stage direction, right? I think that the poor person crossing the threshold and pushing their way through, right? That is what the Amida is about for the rabbis, right? It's that word by Yigash to step forward, and extremely concretely, it's taking 3 steps forward before you see an Amida, which like I had always learned in silent devotion Hebrew school world, right? That's stepping forward before the king, and I always thought it was an act of submission, respect. No, the point of this story is you actually don't belong there. The poor person on the margins of this banquet hall doesn't belong with the king, doesn't really have the authority to have an audience with the king, but by virtue of feeling totally ignored, right, having something that is critical to protest about the sort of status quo of how the world is going, and yet feels sort of not budgeable. There's no room to budge on that. There's sort of the powers that be are not moving on a particular, it seems sort of impossible to imagine an alternative. And right, the poor person pushes through all of that, goes directly to the king, and makes that request. And that I think is the silent devotion of the Amida qua protest, shooting words at God, is really an invitation to move in, right? Step forward, speak up, just like she spoke up to Eli, she speaks up to God. And it's really that invitation to try to do an initial articulation where it's sort of something that is so hard to imagine, you can't even hear yourself say the words. Right, something that sort of seems to fly in the face of reality so much, you can barely articulate it. Right, and the Amida is the invitation to start to articulate that. You form the words in your mouth, even though you can't yet hear them, to try to imagine something that actually seems unimaginable. To make those words of protest begin to be audible. And so that is our Amida, silent devotion /
But that's a
protest.
That's a good drive, because that explains, I mean, that's why the Amida begins with acknowledging that I'm talking to you, King.
Mm-hmm.
You start with acknowledging the King, and only then do you get to the protests and the complaints.
Yeah, but I would say that even that phrase of the King,
it's
not only in the submissive posture, it's also like, I'm gonna step right up.
Step right up.
Right? And sort of, I'm.
I do, yeah.
Part of that stepping up is like, I'm now going to say praises to the King. Like, the fact that I hear saying praises before the King is like a huge risk.
Yeah, there are raises. I mean, they have
a lot of people that really. But this is an extraordinary.